The sight of monarch butterflies, especially in groups, can be breathtaking. When monarchs cluster on tree branches, there's a sea of color and movement. The trouble is, there are not so many Western monarch butterflies out there right now. The year-end count of the insects late last year was similar to the count at the end of 2018, which is to say, low by historic standards. Let's get an idea of the numbers and the efforts to bring them back up before it's too late. Our guest once again is Emma Pelton, who's senior conservation biologist in the Endangered Species Program at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation based in Portland. Emma, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go broad first, just in case people are like catching up on monarchs for the first time. We're talking migratory monarchs. They go way down the west coast of Mexico and then come back.
Yeah, we have monarchs all over the lower 48 states and even into southern Canada during the summer. And then in the fall, monarchs seem to divide themselves around the Rocky Mountains. And east of the Rockies, they go to central Mexico, to Michoacán and the state of Mexico. And west of the Rocky Mountains, they primarily go to the coast of California and a little bit down into Baja along the coast. And then at least in the southwest, we know some monarchs can go either direction. They end up in central Mexico or they go to the coast of California.
So this is a very large migration then. I mean, we're talking, you know, what, millions of insects when things are going right?
Yeah, when things are going right, we used to have millions of insects gathering on the California coast every fall.
All right, so it seems like there's some variability in how people are reporting the results of the last major count of monarchs. What were the numbers like and what do they represent to you?
Yeah, we have over 100 volunteers. It's an incredible effort. People spread up and down the coast. And during this three-week period around Thanksgiving this past year, they counted 29,418 monarchs. And that is a very small number compared to even 2 years ago when we had about 200,000 monarchs. So we've seen this really massive drop in just actually a single year. Last year was very similar to this year. So we're really concerned that the population has plummeted, and even 200,000 was quite low compared to numbers in the 80s and early 90s when we had millions of monarchs.
All right, so even 200,000 low, and we're talking about not, you know, maybe about 8% of that, and it's so that's not very good at all.
Some dizzying math at some point.
Yeah,
right, less than 1% left is what we think now.
Give us an idea of the rate of decline, Emma. Was it steady and then it crashed, or has it been steady all along?
It's been kind of a fascinating process to try to understand this, because really concerted efforts to monitor these sites didn't start until people already thought monarchs were in trouble. So some biologists on the coast, Dennis Fry, David Marriott, and Mia Monroe, really had some foresight before, you know, the terms community science or citizen science were kind of in the popular mind. And so back in 1997, they started to gather records. And since then, we saw a big decline kind of from 1997 and then down through the 2000s and 2010s. We were more at the 200,000 to 300,000 monarchs. But when we've looked back in time, and there are fewer records, but there are still some really good estimates from the 80s, the numbers were much, much higher. So essentially, we now think that there were millions of monarchs in the 80s. The 90s, things get a little bit wacky, and we see, you know, 1 year numbers are really pretty good, the next year they're very low. And then by the time the 2000s roll around, we were at kind of a new steady state low. And then these past 2 years, we've had another massive drop. And so we're concerned that we've now had two really low years, and maybe this is a new normal, and it's very small compared to 20, 30 years ago.
Is it possible the big years of 30 years ago were the aberration?
You know, we have some records, just more anecdotal from newspaper reports, things stretching back into the 1800s. Pacific Grove, there was actually a female scientist wrote a book, Lucy Shepherdson, in 1914, I believe, about the butterfly trees in Pacific Grove and along the coast. And so based on those reports that don't necessarily have really detailed estimates but do give us a sense of the scale, we think that those numbers in the 80s were pretty consistent, that there were millions of monarchs, that this was really an incredible number of butterflies, enough that people were writing books 100 years ago about it. And before that, native tribes had, you know, obviously known that there were butterflies. There's an interesting lack of kind of written history by the Spanish missionaries or kind of anybody in an earlier time period where we would expect this, but potentially that just was never written down because it was so common, and this was not something that people were marveling at because this was every winter, this was normal. So we think that those numbers are probably pretty typical, but it's hard to get, you know, down to really specific numbers without counts.
We were talking about monarch butterflies here on the Jefferson Exchange with Emma Pelton from the Xerces Society based in Portland. She's been keeping an eye on the numbers and giving some idea of what causes the decline and what is underway to try to reverse that decline. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Join us with questions, comments, maybe details about things you've done in your own backyard. We know a lot of people have set up pollinator gardens around the region, and maybe yours are appealing to monarch butterflies as well. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I don't know about you. I get a little uneasy when I hear about the descriptions of, you know, there were so many butterflies at one time in the sky, because I remember reading the same thing about passenger pigeons.
I think there's a good correlation there, and I think I like to think about bison, passenger pigeons as really good analogies, especially because people get a little, you know, confused where if they live in California, or maybe even some of your listeners in, you know, Southern Oregon, where there still have been monarchs in recent years despite the crash. So they'll say, how can this animal be endangered? You know, how can this be at risk? Because I see them in my backyard. And we don't often think of animals at risk as ones that we see in our yards. But because this is an animal that has evolved to be in huge numbers, we don't know how small that population can go before it collapses. It's really a different population structure and kind of way for this animal to move across the landscape. And when they're really spread out in the summer, you might see a monarch in your yard, but that might be the only monarch in, you know, kind of a large area, so it's hard for that monarch to find a mate and reproduce and continue the cycle. So I think getting people to wrap their heads around it and think about other animals that we didn't know we could ever possibly kill all of them until it was too late, like the passenger pigeon, is a really great way to get people to understand the magnitude of the issue.
Yeah, the stories of passenger pigeons back in the 19th century, you could basically lift an oar up from a boat and whack a bunch of them out of the sky. They flew so thickly, but people did just that. Was part of the problem.
Yeah, and monarchs, I mean, it's a little different because we're not obviously directly killing them, but we're indirectly killing them with how we farm, with how we use pesticides around our homes and gardens. We think that the destruction of their overwintering habitat in California, right on the coast where humans like to live and real estate is at a premium, you know, really are adding up to having a negative impact on monarchs, along with a lot of our other bees and butterflies.
Emma, is it possible to allocate percentages to causes of the decline, habitat loss versus pesticide, and are there other factors besides those two?
Yeah, people have tried to look at this. It's always a little bit difficult because usually with any declining species, there's not one smoking gun. So in the case of monarchs, the leading hypotheses, the leading thoughts about what's caused their decline is a loss of this breeding habitat, milkweed and nectar plants, loss of their overwintering habitat, and just the degradation of it. We think climate change is playing some role. Increasing severity and frequency of winter storms along the coast could lead to higher mortality in the winter, prolonged drought, you know, more intense fire season could all be playing a role in changing the landscape. We also think that pesticides, definitely by removing nectar and milkweed from the landscape, and then also neonicotinoids and other insecticides, as well as potentially other pesticides, but especially neonics and other kind of insect-specific compounds that have now, we're using at, you know, unprecedented rates. And we're using them both in our agriculture and in our home and garden scenarios. And so when people go, you know, to buy a plant at a nursery and they think they're doing something to help monarchs, we've actually had reports and now there's kind of emerging data that a lot of those plants that look really beautiful, you know, are being heavily, pesticides are being heavily applied to them to keep them looking really nice. And so you can potentially poison or kill, you know, monarch caterpillars by putting out a plant that you bought at a store if that their goal is to produce a plant and not necessarily to help you, you know, support bees and butterflies in your backyard. So there's kind of a tangled mess with pesticides that I think it's really harder for people to wrap their heads around. Planting milkweed is something that a lot of people have really grasped, and that's great, but we actually think there's a lot of other factors that we need to be unraveling, because we could plant all the milkweed we want, and if it's poisoned and if they're going to die at their overwintering sites, you know, we're not really going to get to the core root of the issue.
How important is connectivity to the monarchs? We had talked earlier this week with a different guest about the fact that we got to think beyond just these little islands of habitat for various creatures so they can get around. I mean, if they have like a 20 or 40 mile gap between milkweeds, is that sort of death to a migrating patch of monarchs?
I think monarchs are a little bit incredible and maybe an exception. They're maybe not like the best example, because I think connectivity is absolutely really important for most of our insects or a lot of our other wildlife species, but monarchs are incredible flyers. I mean, they migrate to Mexico, they migrate to the coast of California. They can fly hundreds or thousands of miles. So in terms of insects, they're really resilient. And if there is just one milkweed, you know, they might find it. And I've seen this in Nevada. There'll be a single small plant on a hillside, and we haven't seen anything in miles, and we'll find a caterpillar on it, which is just kind of incredible. So I think in some ways monarchs are the exception, but we also know that the more habitat there is, the more connected it is, they are more successful. If a female can lay, you know, 100 eggs in a day because there's a lot of milkweed and then there's plenty of nectar for her to refuel, she's going to do better. Her offspring are probably going to do better than if she needs to fly 20 miles and that's her whole day just to lay a single egg on a plant. So I think both are true, but monarchs might be more resilient than a lot of our other animals.
Okay, well, that's good to know. So they may respond to the efforts to bring them back just a bit better. In terms of offspring, and I know I ask you this every time that we talk about monarchs, but it is a generational change from one end of the migration to the next, isn't it? It's not the same butterflies returning as left, correct?
Yeah, correct. And this is what's different than birds, than migrating birds. I think it's just still an incredible mystery that every monarch that makes it to an overwintering site has never been there before. So they're not showing each other. We actually still don't fully know how they find and why they select the places they spend the winter. So I think that's incredible. It means that these animals have a really finely honed sense of where they need to be in the winter, because we'll find them on the same branch of the same tree, but there hasn't been a monarch on that tree for, you know, 9 months, and all of the progeny that were there last year, you know, have been dead for three generations.
Emma Pelton is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, senior conservation biologist for the Endangered Species Program at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, based in Portland. Highly interested in the success of the monarch butterfly, the western monarch butterfly. The counts are very low again this year. What, 29,000 something, is it?
Correct. Yeah, okay. 29,000.
Mm-hmm. You can join the conversation on the exchange and ask your questions of Emma and about the ideas for restoring habitat and livability for monarch butterflies in the West. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join the conversation by phone, send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We've been talking in terms of endangered species. Is that where monarchs are? Are they protected under federal and state law?
They are not, and we're going to see if they become that by the end of this year. Monarchs were petitioned to be listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act back in 2014, and the Fish and Wildlife Service was supposed to issue a decision this past summer, but they've reached an agreement to push that decision out, especially, I think, because we've seen this really kind of divergent population trends. Mexico numbers are kind of on the upswing modestly, and in the West, we've seen this massive crash. So they're collecting, they're waiting for the second year of winter data to help inform their models and their decisions. So we expect a decision by the end of this year. And if they are listed, you know, that could have implications in their protection. But if they're not listed, there are right now no states that have any listed protection for monarchs. So especially in the state of California, I think it's really something we need to work on, because these overwintering sites continue to be cut down. And there are sites right now that are at risk of being developed, and we don't have any legal way to stop most of those development proposals.
Monterey, Salinas, Santa Cruz, are these kind of the hot spots for the monarchs?
Yeah, the Central Coast is really the core of their overwintering range, but they're even found in the southern Mendocino County. Historically, they're still currently kind of found in that Sonoma, Marin area. Bolinas actually has pretty good numbers. And then if you get down into L.A., numbers start to really trickle off. But historically, there used to be pretty good numbers down into San Diego and Baja. Now we see many fewer.
You had mentioned earlier, Emma, about being concerned that the monarch numbers don't get too low. Do we know what the number might be at which point the population is unrecoverable? I mean, 29,000, it doesn't sound great compared to historic levels. I mean, are there enough monarchs, do we think, for the population to rebound?
We're not sure. I think we're in a giant experiment right now. Just a few years ago, scientists set a bar of about 30,000, which they thought was a minimum, and that the population needed to stay above 30,000. Otherwise, it would risk collapsing and kind of a one-track downward spiral in terms of numbers. But that's an educated guess. And so so we don't know, and usually people never know until it's too late, how small an animal population can get before you go to this point of no return, in a sense. So we're right at that threshold, essentially, about that 30,000. So we're really hoping that guess was wrong. We're really hoping that they can go this low, and they can even maybe go lower if they end up going lower before we can recover them. But we will not know, and I really think we're witnessing kind of this unfolding in real time, and it might take a few more years for us to know if they can bounce back or if, you know, we're going to just still see really small numbers of monarchs from here on out.
So clearly some things we still need to understand about monarch butterflies. The numbers would certainly help. But what are some of the other gaps in our knowledge, things that it would really help us to know about monarch butterflies that are still something of a mystery?
Yeah, I really love monarchs. One of the most well-studied butterflies in North America, and yet there's so much we don't know. And I think together that's why I really like working on them, because we know enough to act, and we also have a lot of mysteries to figure out. And monarchs have really in the past and still today really relied on the community to understand them, because they are in your backyard. It's a lot harder to contribute to wolverine science per se, unless you want to, you know, go to a really remote place and maybe never see one. So I think what's great about the monarch conservation community is that a wide range of people can participate in helping understand these mysteries. So some of the top ones I like to point to is understanding parasites. We think that parasite levels, particularly in the West and in California, when people are planting non-native tropical milkweed, because it's widely available, and some years ago we didn't know that it was causing such a problem, and it really spreads a parasite called OE. So asking people to test their monarchs for this parasite and send it in to a community science project in Georgia called Project Monarch Health, that's trying to really understand parasites and how that affects monarch populations and other butterflies, is a really cool project. Another question that we have is really trying to better understand where monarchs are and what they're doing in the spring period. They've mostly left the overwintering sites by now. There's just a few sites that have good numbers left on the coast of California. So we know those monarchs are trying to go inland, starting to go north. And this is when the population's at its smallest, because they haven't reproduced yet. And they're maybe vulnerable to late winter storms. And so better understanding how far inland they go, is their milkweed up? If so, what species? Are they nectaring? What are they relying on for nectar? Would help us better understand this early spring period. And this year, there's a special project called the Western Monarch Mystery Challenge, and you can look it up on social media. It's got Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, and there's a special push by Washington State University along with other partners to try and better understand where monarchs are. And so people can take a photo of a monarch, even a blurry photo, send it into them directly, or put it in iNaturalist. And all of that data will kind of help us better understand where they are. And that will really help us hone in on where we should put efforts. Are they in the Coast Range? Are they more in the Central Valley? Are they in the northern half of California? Or do we see them more evenly spread through the state? That'll really help when the population's at this critically low point, better direct resources and understand maybe what milkweeds we should be growing out so that we have milkweeds for the right part of California, because, hey, they're all up in Mendocino County, and I don't think that's the case. But right. If they were, it would help us kind of inform efforts.
But that's really interesting that we're talking about these non-native milkweeds. So people have attempted to help by putting milkweed in, but it's not the kind of milkweed that help the monarchs, it appears.
Yeah, it's a really tricky question, and it evokes a lot of strong emotions because, and I understand it, people have planted these plants for up to 20 years. Tropical milkweed kind of came online in the 90s. It's pretty easy to grow, and it's a really attractive flower. It can be some really, they have different varieties, but red and orange and yellow. So it's really a vibrant flower, and it's native not to the U.S. It's native further south, and so it acts more like an evergreen in our more mild climates. So the problem is that plant really became the dominant plant available when you went to a big box store, and so people were like hearing that monarchs are declining. They go to their nursery, you know, they go to their big box store, and that is the plant available. That's the milkweed available. So, of course, that's what you purchase. But now that we have had this plant on the landscape for 20-odd years, we've seen that it's naturalized in certain areas, like in Florida. And in Florida, we have the longest record of really tropical milkweed creating a non-migratory population artificially. So now there are monarchs that do not leave that kind of peninsula of Florida, And we've seen similar things on the Gulf Coast with Texas, and then we're seeing it in Southern California and coastal California. So it's actually creating, it's interrupting the migration, and the monarchs that are using this tropical milkweed can become highly diseased, up to 100% infection with this parasite. And this parasite can be completely debilitating or even kill monarchs. And so modeling has shown that this, if you have really high rates of this this parasite because of a tropical milkweed patch, you can really see a dip in the population size. So people think, oh, it's okay that I have caterpillars in December. I'm still producing caterpillars in my garden. But we actually think that that could be harming the population overall, because then if that caterpillar does grow up and survive the parasites, it's going to spread those parasites to healthy monarchs, and then those offspring don't do as well. So it's kind of a vicious circle, and you have to kind of scale out from what you see in your garden to what the whole population needs. And so we're really trying to get people to think about switching out that tropical milkweed for native milkweeds, and then get some native nectar plants and other plants that provide resources for bees and butterflies and don't have this kind of problematic cycle. So it's slow going, and you know, people are pretty resistant to, you know, taking out plants that they may have had planted for years in the hopes that it was helping monarchs. So it's sometimes, you know, talking to people one at a time and helping them kind of see how this is better for the butterflies in the long term, even if it's a hard thing to wrap your head around when you see caterpillars in your garden and you're like, oh, this is great. I'm helping.
Yeah, all kinds of things to think about. We're down to our last couple seconds. You can hear the music about to play us out, Emma. Do you have some, are you cautiously optimistic? How would you describe your feeling about the move ahead?
Yeah, I think I'm optimistic because I have seen an upswelling of public support for Western monarchs. And I think we need everybody, and I'm really excited that we have seen this upwelling of people getting engaged and doing things for bees and butterflies. So on that end, I think that whatever we do to help save Western monarchs will also help benefit a lot of our other species, and that is worth celebrating.
All right. The Western Monarch Call to Action is spearheaded by the Xerces Society, where Emma Pelton works. She's senior conservation biologist in the Endangered Species Program, obviously very well up on what's going on with Western monarchs. Emma, as always, thank you for the news and the outlook.
Thanks so much for having me.